and welcome to David's Book Talk. Today we're going to talk to an Edgar Award winner, a newly Edgar Award winner. Her name is Stephanie Pintoff, and she's here to talk about her new novel, A Curtain Falls. Hello.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me today.
You have a wonderful voice. It's just very soothing. I like that.
Thank you.
I'm trying to decide which book I like better, In the Shadow of Gotham or A Curtain Falls. They're both such interesting books. In fact, when I was reading A Curtain Falls, there was a point in the book where I thought, wow, this is just a great book.
Oh, thank you.
Do you ever feel that way about books?
I do, all the time. I've been a reader for a long time before I was a writer, and that's still my favorite thing. There's no bigger pleasure than discovering something that you lose yourself in. Surprises you maybe in some way. And I think that's what some of the best mysteries do.
It's interesting because it doesn't happen with every book with me. There's some books I read and I'm like, okay, I'm glad that's done. Now I'm moving on,
Right.
And the other books you can't get enough of, and you almost don't want to. And that's how I feel about In the Shadow of Gotham. I don't want it to end.
Oh, thank you.
Because now I've got to wait another year for the characters to come back.
You do, yes.
Now, they're already comparing this to The Alienist, which was a wonderful novel of, I don't know how many years ago. How many years has it been since The Alienist? 10?
I think even longer.
Yeah.
I think it was more mid-90s.
Now, obviously, they're two separate books and two very, very different in a lot of ways. But there is kind of that feel that reminds you of The Alienist. Did you mean to do that, or was it just something that happened?
I think it was more something that happened. I'm definitely fascinated with the same things that Caleb Carr is. We both are very interested in early serial killers and early criminology. But he's looking at it from a very psychological angle. I mean, even the title of his book, The Alienist, right? Whereas I'm a little more interested in the law angle. I have my character who is a law professor at Columbia. And on a very practical level, how ordinary policemen like my protagonist, Detective Zeal, are in real life incorporating some of those techniques into their everyday policing, which was done at the time much more so than people realize. I think also that maybe it's even just that simple decade that separates The Alienist from my work. Those 10 years were huge in terms of both what policemen were doing in the city and even just the city itself. My New York at the turn of the century is a little bit more modern. We've got subways and automobiles, and the streets are filled with that. They've got people and pedestrians and subways and automobiles, and they don't necessarily get along very well. And for me, that's a very visceral image that sort of symbolizes what's going on in terms of the ideology of the time, too. You've got the modern and the sort of late Victorian Edwardian, and the ideas are clashing with each other, and they don't necessarily get along very well.
And you read that an apartment was $25 rent a month, and you think, oh my word, you just can't even imagine an apartment that what we would consider cheap nowadays.
Exactly.
I mean, there's such a huge difference between what it was then and what it is now, and you're like, boy, I wish apartments were that cheap now.
I do too.
But you still have the feel of this book that these characters have, they survive, they eke out a living, but nobody seems very rich in this book.
No, except for Alistair and his family.
Oh, Alistair, yes, yes.
Yes.
But poor Alistair's had some tragedy in his family, though.
He has, yes.
In fact,
no one's immune.
Yeah. Yeah, and Isabella is such an interesting woman, too. She's sort of like a woman's liber, almost. Not quite as woman's liber as maybe Gloria Steinem, but strength to her, that she's for women, that she's women's rights kind of.
Exactly. But in a very traditional sort of way.
When did you decide you were going to write mysteries? I mean, has it been a while, or has it been a while in your head, or is it just recently that you decided to really give it a try?
It's been a long time in my head. Mysteries are always my favorite thing to read, growing up as a child. And
what did you read? What was the first mystery you read?
The first one I remember reading is Nancy Drew. Everyone says that, right?
Right, exactly. I did too. So.
But I think it really is most people's introduction. I remember going very quickly from there through the Agatha Christie and the Sherlock Holmes and just devouring all of it. I loved it. It was a very long time before I had the idea that I might actually write one myself. But it's long been my favorite genre.
And I think it is mine, too. And people at the store say I'm too much into mysteries and thrillers. But you like what you like. And, I mean, I'll read anything as long as it's good.
Yeah.
I don't even a romance novel, I'll read. Not that I have anything against romance novels. I know there's a lot of people that love them. But
right.
They're just not for me completely. But a good romance novel I would read. If it was interesting and I really liked the characters. I mean, I can read Nicholas Sparks every once in a while and have a good time reading him. I mean, he's not the best I've ever read, but he tells a story just like any other author.
Oh, exactly.
And it's just that some stories are more interesting than others, and that yours are just fascinating to read. I mean, you just... there's a smoothness to your writing, too, which is amazing. I mean, it's just... nothing's rough, and you find out everything by the end of the book. And it's just... And the chapters seem to be just the right length, you know?
Oh, good.
And it makes for a very enjoyable read, not just an interesting read, an enjoyable one.
Oh, good.
And that's why, one of the reasons we're talking right now, because I just enjoy these books so much.
Thank you.
And the covers, I mean, where did these covers come from? Snow seems to be a pattern in your books now.
You know, I have the most amazing covers, and I can honestly take no credit. David Rothstein. At St. Martin's Press Minotaur, he's amazing with book covers, and he reads every book before he comes up with the cover design for it. And
really,
I've been lucky that he's come up with such amazing designs for mine.
And this bridge on A Curtain Falls is just—it's fun to look at. I like the way it curves. It's just an interesting.
Yeah.
Is that actually in New York?
It is. It's in Central Park. And ironically, I don't think it's much more than about 30 yards away from the Angel of the Waters in Central Park.
Have you ever been on the bridge?
Countless times. I've walked my dog on that bridge.
Really?
Hundreds of times.
So do you think about your book when you're walking your dog?
I do now.
Do you?
I do.
You seem like a very easygoing person, very, very easy to talk to. And were you nervous when you won the Edgar?
I wasn't nervous until the moment they called my name. I really didn't think they were going to call mine. Just wasn't expecting it. Hadn't even prepared a speech to accept with. And on the elevator on the way down to the banquet hall, my husband asked me, said, you know, well, have you prepared anything? Well, no. He's like, well, by any chance, if they call your name, will you be okay? I'm like, yes, I will. I'll wing it. It'll be fine. And it was fine, but I was very nervous those 10 seconds walking up, and, you know, wasn't quite ready and prepared for this, but it was fine. It was amazing.
And usually the book that wins is an interesting book. I've read most of them that won, and there are always something interesting about the book.
Yeah. Well, no, and this year I was in particularly amazing company. It was a very strong field this year.
Yeah, that's great. That makes it even better that you won. It must mean you are as good as they say you are.
It also probably means that the judges had a very difficult choice.
I would think if you read all five, what if you liked all five equally as well? How in the world would you choose one over the other?
Each one was so different.
I don't remember the titles that were up, but...
Yeah, I guess I was the only historical, but... You know, the apples and oranges and pears, I'm not sure how they managed to compare, because I'm sure each book had its own strengths and weaknesses.
Now, what's your background? What kind of a name is Pintos?
It's Russian.
Oh, you're Russian? How interesting.
Oh, I'm a little bit of everything, probably.
And Russians are a lot of times good writers. A lot of good Russian writers.
Yeah.
Seems like.
Yeah. Not like the Irish, but.
Did you always have this? Did you always know that you were going to get published, or were there days where you weren't sure?
Plenty of days I wasn't sure.
But didn't you know as you were writing that it was you were writing good stuff? Didn't it feel like you were writing really good stuff?
Some days, and other days, you know.
I mean, what would
self doubts that I think every writer has.
What would people say when you'd give them the book to read? What would they say to you? They must have thought it was really great.
I didn't give it to them to read.
Oh, really? You gave it to nobody to read?
I gave it to my husband. I think he's the only one who ever read it cover to cover before. I took the Cinderella route, I like to say, into publication when I entered into the St. Martin's Minotaur Mystery Writers of America contest. And they basically agreed that, you know, you submit it, they were going to pick a winner, the winner was going to be published, like the most amazing award for a writer's contest. So I had finished my manuscript and really had no idea what to do next. And, you know, I'd read a lot of other contest winners, not from my contest, it was the first year for my contest, but St. Martin's has always done a private eye contest.
Right.
So people like Steve Hamilton and Michael Kurita came out of that. And then they also had a traditional mystery contest. And I'd read Donna Andrews and the other mystery writers from there. So I was kind of familiar that this was a career path that, you know, it had launched a number of my favorite writers. So I decided I would give it a try and see what happened. You know, if nothing else, the contest deadline gave me a deadline.
Right.
I so worked better with that.
The deadlines help, despite what the writers will curse about. You know,
I have
a deadline. What am I going to do? You know, how am I going to get this done? You know, and
yeah.
All the worry and about getting it done. And when you read In the Shadow of Gotham, when you read it, Curtain Falls, they're both equally as interesting. And you think to yourself, wow, she has this all planned out. It makes wonderful sense. It just flows so smoothly. I mean, is that difficult to do with every book for you? Or does it come easy for you?
I'm not aware I'm doing it. So, you know, it's really, I guess, the only thing that's in my head is trying to write the best books I can. And I'm huge on closure. That's the one thing that will always satisfy me the most about a good mystery, if I reach the end and all the loose ends are tied up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always something I'm aiming for, which that must, I think, generate some of the smoothness you're talking about. But yeah, you're making it up as you go along in your head, but I guess when the pieces fit, I know it.
And the interesting thing, you know, the Curtain Falls is, the background is acting. There's a lot of acting stuff and people,
yeah.
Actors and actresses. And when I first read the book, I thought, oh, this is just going to be another mystery about actors and then there's going to be a murder, sort of like a Murder, She Wrote kind of thing where the backstage, but it's so much more complex. It's so much more interesting than that. And I was extremely pleased that it was more than just a simple mystery like that. I mean, it could have been just a simple mystery, but it isn't.
Oh, good.
and you realize as you go along in this book that there's so much more to it. There's so much more depth to the story,
yeah.
That you didn't realize there was going to be at first. And things just keep happening. And that, of course, that's the more that happens. I think a lot of times the more that happens, the more interesting the book really is. Because if you read the old Agatha Christie, sometimes she'd go 100 pages and nothing would happen.
Right.
Look at And Then There Were None. The first 100 pages are the most boring pages you'll ever read. And then all of a sudden they get on the island and everything starts to happen.
Exactly, and you can't put it down.
But you don't seem to be boring at all in any part of the book. There's always something happening. There's always something going on in your books. Do you try to do that with every book?
I am trying. You know, I think part of it is the right sort of setting or the right questions. You know, I love the idea of Broadway theater for the second book as a setting because I've been reading about it and You know, I've been a fan of the old Hollywood movies of the 1930s and 40s. Huge fan as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I was familiar with the Hollywood studio system and how that built up the actors and, you know, at the same time was a somewhat insular, sort of competitive environment. And I didn't realize until I was doing more research in my time period that the same environment existed in the theater world of 1906, but in spades, like putting to shame anything I ever read about in Hollywood. And I just thought, you know, that's a perfect environment to explore, and really the perfect environment for murder, because so many people who are involved in that kind of environment, you know, just all the emotions of desire and ambition.
Egos, too.
Exactly.
I mean, terrible ego. I mean, big egos.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm better than you are kind of egos, or, you know, they just know they're good.
Right. And they want to own it all.
That's what makes Meryl Streep so wonderful. She's great, and she doesn't acknowledge that she's great.
Right.
I mean, she's just a down-to-earth person, and that seems to be a rarity in the actor and actress field, you know.
Yeah.
People, there's a lot of egos there, and there's a lot of pamper, and you know, all kinds of stuff goes on.
Right.
But, and I noticed you the plays that you mentioned, were they real plays that went on back then?
Almost all of them. I don't want to say universally all of them, because I think I made up a couple of them.
Right.
Actually, the actual murder plays I made up, just because I was going to be killing someone off in their production. But some of the Frohman theaters I talk about were really Frohman theaters. The Shakespeare repertory that was going on, you know, that was accurate. That was actually in place.
And you mentioned Maude Adams a lot.
Yes, and she was the huge star of the day.
Not the Maude Adams we know that came later on.
No, but she was Charles Frohman's biggest star. And some of the material that I've incorporated in the book was really true. He believed that the actors and actresses who worked for him had to work just as hard on their image offstage as on stage. So he had rules, you know, don't ever be seen walking down Broadway, I need my stars photographed only on Fifth Avenue, and someone might snap a shot of you if you're on the wrong street.
Well, that wouldn't go over real big today.
Oh, impossible today. But it did back then, and I'm always amazed by what sort of psychological relationship there must have been between top actors in Frohman. Maude Adams, just as one example, when Frohman eventually died, and he actually had a hero's death aboard the Lusitania when it was sunk.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was in the water literally trying to save babies.
Now you could make a novel out of that.
Oh, you could. Actually, probably somebody has. But Maude Adams was at the height of her career when he died. And she went to his funeral, and she cried, and she went home, and she never acted again another day in her life.
Hmm. Amazing.
Yeah. So I guess when I read about that and I think on it, I realize that, you know, whatever control he exercised, this wasn't one-sided. You know, the actors and actresses were definitely participating in some level.
He's almost like a psychological bully.
In some ways, although, you know, you read accounts of what a good and generous man he was, and...
Oh, really?
The one thing in every account I've read that was clear is just how much he loved theater. So, I definitely, and this is what I tried to present in the book to be accurate to his image, you know, everything he does, he's really doing from the purest of goals. He wants to make this theater better, as good as it can. And certainly his detractors point out that, you know, there's a dark side to that, but...
Well, there's always been a dark side to anything to do with Hollywood or the Broadway stage. I mean, there's always... And I've always been fascinated by Broadway. I mean, you see a live performance and you realize that any second they could mess up.
Yeah.
And it just makes it more exciting and more thrilling to see real talent. I mean, when you're performing on the Broadway stage, you can't be a slacker. You can't say, well, I'm sick, I can't go on today. You just do it.
Right.
And you have to make it as interesting and as believable as possible.
Right.
But the actors seem to love it. They seem to love doing plays.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't know how they do all the memorization. It just enthralls me to think of all the memorizing. Not only do you have to memorize your lines, you have to know where your lines come in respect to everybody else's.
Exactly.
I don't know how they do it. I mean, it just amazes me night after night. And you're doing it night after night after night. I mean, when you're doing a TV or a movie, you can stop, but you can't stop.
Exactly. And you have to keep it fresh, as you were saying.
But to see a play, I remember seeing an Agatha Christie play performed live. It's just fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, now you have two books out. I assume this is going to be an ongoing series.
It is. Yes, I'm working on the third.
I can hardly wait to read the next one.
Thank you.
And I really mean that. I mean, I may have to come to your house and get it.
It's not done yet.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll take whatever you. I find myself not being able to wait to see what's going to happen to the characters next.
Oh, good.
And I think everybody who reads the series is going to feel that way. I can guarantee it, because it's just a fascinating series. I mean, Zeal and Alistair are sort of like a fascinating couple together. I want to see more of them figuring out who the criminal is.
Oh, good.
And figure out, you know how sort of like Lincoln Rhyme does in his books, where he figures the psychology of the villain. I like that kind of thing, and figuring out things and getting fingerprints. And of course, the fingerprints were just coming into use as evidence in your books.
Exactly, and they're not trusted, at least not in Detective Zeal's world. The one place that they were trusted in 1905, 1906 New York is ironically in the prison system. They would use it to identify their prisoners.
Oh.
That was because in that setting, they could put a person in the room and they could get 10 perfect, pristine prints. You know, if they got a print that they didn't like, they could do it over, you know? But in real life, in real crime scenes, you know, it didn't work that way. You never had 10 full prints. You had a lot of messy partials. And that was where the skepticism came from. You know, it wasn't necessarily that they didn't believe it was a solid marker of identification. It was just they believed that the way you got it from a crime scene, you know, in that kind of scattered, haphazard fashion, could you really trust?
Now, wasn't Theodore Roosevelt like some kind of city official in New York in the early 1900s? Or was that the 1800s?
That was the 1800s.
Oh, that was the 1800s. That's Oops.
Caleb Carr's time period.
1800s,
yeah.
Okay. I knew he was some kind of, he was governor or something, wasn't he?
Well, by my time period, he's president. He became president in 1901 when McKinley was assassinated by the anarchists. And that's actually the subject material of my third book. I'm taking Detective Zeal into through the underworld of New York with secret societies and anarchist plots.
Huh.
A lot of anarchy.
That sounds really interesting. Now, do the ideas come quickly to you, or does it? I mean, the general idea must come quick, but I mean, the idea for the whole book, does that take time to generate in your mind?
It takes time to play with. You know, getting ideas is never the hard part. I guess, like most writers, I have a very overactive imagination. So, almost so far, every book has been really a matter of putting together sort of two or three ideas I have that are interesting and making them come together in a unique way.
And that's hard. It sounds really difficult.
Maybe. It's fun, though. You know, whenever I'm starting a book, I'm spending probably about 3 to 4 months, I'll say, researching. But part of that is also playing. It's just seeing how different ideas fit together, whether different threads that interest me, you know, could they work together in the same story? And and would it make for a better story, or no, no, that's not right for this story. Let's put it aside for now.
Right.
So.
And you have to decide that, but how do you decide who, what's going to be the most interesting story to tell?
Honestly, what excites me the most, what I find the most interesting. There are plenty of story ideas that I'll put it. I have this big corkboard of post-it notes, and that's how I keep track of those opening initial ideas. And the ones that I'm the most excited about, they stick, and the ones I'm not, I kind of rip them off and shove them in the desk, and I may come back to them in a later book, but not the one I'm doing now.
Joe, in the first book, is it Joe, the guy that he works with, that has the stroke?
Yes.
So, did he have it? Was he in the second book? I think he was, wasn't he?
If he was, it was the smallest cameo.
Right.
It was a very small cameo.
Because when I read the first book, I'm thinking, I don't remember Joe having the stroke in the second book. I didn't know that it was,
yeah.
The stroke isn't integral to the mystery. I'm not giving anything away.
Exactly.
It has nothing to do with the mystery. It's just something that happens to him.
I think in the second book, you're aware of him as a presence, but the second book is taking Zeal back into the city, and that's more of where his future is going to lie. So it represents sort of a character movement for him. In the first book in Gotham, essentially he's depressed. He's had a lot of terrible things happen, lost his fiancée in the slogan. And part of that kind of reawakening and coming back to life is coming back to the city, which has both an attraction and a repulsion for him. But that's what's going to draw him.
Now, did you do a lot of historical research of the times before you started writing the first book?
I did a lot of it without knowing I was doing it. By which I mean, I was always the kind of person who, before I picked up a computer and started writing chapter one, before I even thought I was going to write a novel, I love doing things like seeing in the paper on the Saturday, oh wow, there's a new walking tour of the Lower East Side, I want to go check that out. Or one of my favorite things, the Architectural Institute about 5 years ago, they had this incredible open house among the different mansions of the Upper East Side. And you could go through, you could see their ballrooms, you saw their servants' quarters, and they even had staff on hand that give a little presentation about who had lived in the house throughout its history. So those were the sort of things that always interested me a long time before. And I think by the time I was ready to write, it was in my head and just there ready to draw. Of course, I also did things. I mean, certain things are just invaluable. I'm lucky in New York. There's so many great libraries. From the photographs you can find, to the old menus you can find. Even one thing that's indispensable, I found a 1906 tourist guide, literally the farmers of its era. And, just this really great list of restaurants, hotels, but better than that, subway maps and schedules. So you can literally see where the stops were, that it took 13 minutes to get from City Hall to 72nd Street, ferry schedules, all of those, like a very basic road map. Those kinds of things are invaluable. Because essentially I'm visiting a world that isn't really known to me. I see vestiges around me every day in modern New York, but it's not the same.
Right, right. And it has to, these novels have to have the feel of the times, or they wouldn't be authentic as they are.
Exactly.
They have to have, you have to make sure there aren't things in it that weren't there at the time,
Right, exactly.
And there's no cell phones, of course, and it's hard to get a hold of people, and I don't know, did they even have answering machines back then?
Oh, no.
They didn't have any. I don't know what year the answering machine came into existence, but it seems like it's been here forever. But
it does, just like computers. Right?
And they didn't have any TVs back then either, did they?
Oh no, I think that was 40s, 50s. I'm not even sure, but yeah.
So you wonder what they did at night. I mean, what occupied their... Of course, they all went out to dinner a lot, too.
They went out to dinner a lot. They went to theater and music, and or they stayed home and read books. You know, especially in the upper classes, they had these amazing home libraries.
Is there a plan for, in a future book, to relive what Zeal went through with his wife?
There's going to be a little more that comes out in every book that I have planned.
Do you know his full background right now?
Most of it. More of it may come to me along the way.
Well, how much, what percentage of do you think the reader knows so far with these two books of what really happened?
Maybe 25.
Well, not very much. We don't know.
Not very much, no. In the third book that I'm working on, the case he's on actually takes him back into the Lower East Side and in contact with Hannah's family for the first time.
Yeah, I want more psychological stuff. I love the psychological stuff, and with him and with all the characters.
Yeah.
The more psychological it is, to me, the more interesting the book is.
Good.
And that's what I want to see. Because there's a lot of books nowadays that authors are writing so fast sometimes that you don't really get a feel of the characters like you should on some of these books. And how could you if you're writing three or four books a year like some of these authors are doing? You don't feel like you know the person. I mean, when you shot this book, you should feel like you know these characters.
Right.
Maybe not every one, but the main ones anyway.
Yeah.
And how often does that happen? It doesn't happen with every book. So, do you only read mysteries?
I read primarily mysteries, in large part now because time is limited and I want to keep up with what's going on in my field. And it's always been my favorite, too. I do try to branch out. I will enjoy other things, but it's primarily mysteries for me right now.
So you got a little statue of Edgar Allan Poe? That was your...
I did.
Award. And who handed it to you? I'm curious.
Jane Clelland. And Steve Hamilton.
Oh.
I recall I mentioned Steve Hamilton as one of my favorite writers from long before I entered the contest that launched me into publication.
He wrote a book, and I don't know which one it was. I should remember these titles, but there was a whole book about playing cards.
I haven't read that one.
And it's just extraordinary. Yeah. I mean, he can take a small card game and make a huge... hugely fascinating book out. He's just the nicest man too. I've met him and talked to him. He's just really, really nice. You're in good company there. Minotaur has a lot of good writers now.
They do.
It seems like they're getting more with each passing year.
Yeah.
I think you just got Nevada Barr too. I think she's now with St. Martin's too.
Yeah, maybe.
And
I was at CJ Box the night of the Edgar's banquet, and he's one of my favorites as well.
Yeah, he's a nice guy too. I can see him in his cowboy hat.
Yes, which he took off for dinner, but he had it with him.
It's hard to believe. I can't imagine not having it on. Every picture you see, he's got the hat on. It's like,
right?
Is he really a cowboy in real life?
That I'm not sure about. He certainly looks like he could be, the nicest man.
So is book three done even as we speak?
I'm sorry?
You said book three wasn't done yet, didn't you?
It's very close, but not quite done. It will be done by August 1st.
August 1st. So you have plenty of time. You got nothing to worry about. Do you ever lay awake at night wondering where to go with your plot next?
I do, and the answer usually comes around 3 in the morning.
3 in the morning? What happens at 3 in the morning?
I wake up, I turn on my light, and I jot down the idea that is the answer. Literally, I keep a...
And that really happens each time?
It really happens more times than I care to count. Whenever I'm really stuck with something. You know, I guess it's something that you're living with when you're walking the dog or doing the laundry, even when you're not actually at the computer working. And for some reason, a lot of times, the solution seems to come in the middle of the night. I started keeping pen and paper right by the nightstand, so when it hits, I can jot it down and still remember.
I've heard that's a good thing to keep pen and paper by your nightstand.
Yeah.
But I think they talk about it more with dreams than they do with books.
Probably.
Although, Dennis Lehane claims that he dreamed up all of Shutter Island.
Really?
he claims that that whole book was a dream of his. And when you read the book, you'll be totally fascinated hearing that. I mean, it's just because it's such an unusual book. You'll never read another book like it.
Yeah.
And so you currently read a lot of mysteries. Does reading other mysteries help you with your writing, you think?
I think it must.
How does it help?
I think you learn something. There's some sort of takeaway from almost every book I read that's really good. You know, for example, I just finished the Stieg Larsson series.
Oh, that's a great series.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, sort of one of the takeaways there is just what a fabulous character he created in Lisbeth Salander. Just fascinating.
Talk about a strong woman.
Yeah.
Not afraid of anybody.
And the psychology that you were talking about as well. So, you know, reading something like that, it certainly doesn't mean I'm about to write the next Swedish thriller in my own person, but it's a reminder of things that are important in the stories that I enjoy most, and to make sure I don't, or try my best to incorporate those kinds of elements in what I'm going to write. So that there's some lesson like that in almost every book that I really enjoy.
How many drafts do you do of a typical book? Like, how many did you do of A Curtain Falls?
I guess one incredibly messy draft that no one should read, a tighter draft that I finished, and that was the one my editor got. She goes through it, then there's another draft, then there's copy editing, and then the whole production typesetting process. So it's probably about six drafts from start to finish.
That's a lot. I mean, that's amazing. Over and over, reading the same things over and over, and to make it sound. Do you always know when you have it as good as you're going to get it?
You never have it as good as you want it, ever. My favorite quote is one by Ernest Hemingway. He says something to the effect that good writing is never done; it's just due. You have.
To, oh, that's cute.
Yeah, you have to stop, and I mean, I could always take a draft and make it better. In some ways, I think I'm a better editor-reviser than I am a writer, because I love that process of taking the bones of something and making them better and as good as I can get them. So, but that's actually probably been the hardest thing for me, seeing work in publication. It's realizing that, you know, you've got to, at some point, you have to let go. And you're done. You can't
do it
anymore.
I think it was in the first book that the young woman that was working on the mathematics problem is that a real problem?
It is a real problem.
It is, because I was tempted to look it up on the internet. I don't think I ever did, but I was going to, and I thought, I wonder if it's really something that.
Hilbert was a very famous turn of the last century mathematician, and he gave a speech where he identified the 10 biggest math problems of the century, and that was one of them. And ironically, he actually thought it was one of the easier ones. He predicted that it would be solved in the first decade of the 20th century, and it's actually still unsolved today. Was it Harvard? It was Harvard or some other Boston organization offered $1 million prize last year if someone could solve problem by, I think, December 31st.
And nobody did.
So, to my knowledge, it's still unsolved as of today.
That was fascinating. I love that aspect of the book, and I thought, it almost seemed like it had to be real, because it didn't seem made up at all, for some reason.
Yeah.
It just seemed like, you know, the dynamic, the relationship between him and the young girl, you know, here's a young woman and an older man who relate to each other in mathematics.
Right. Exactly.
And, you know, and you kind of feel sorry for these two, because, you know, society would never accept that. They would just think he was preying on a young woman, you know,
exactly,
with sex in mind. And you know, and you think to yourself, they related to everything but sex.
Yes.
And, you know, but society just assumes the worst, instead of assuming that maybe they have something in common that they're really excited about.
Right. And I had taken one real life example I ran across of a female mathematician of that time period who, you know, everyone assumed that her work had to have been done by her husband, her brother, her lover. But what's been amazing is how many emails I have gotten from women in the mathematics field who have said they had that experience much more recently. I was amazed.
That is great. I mean, and do you think that you have all the confidence you need to write? Or do you build, does your confidence build with each book that comes out?
I think no writer has all the confidence that they might want to have.
Do you ever wake up in the morning and think, oh, I'm just a bad writer?
Of course.
You do? But you're not, though.
I think that's maybe in part what makes up the drive for certain writers to want to be better, to want to make every book better than the last, because if you are so satisfied, you would stop, you know?
Well, I'm curious what it was like for you the first time you read from your first book. Is that an awkward thing for you?
You know, by the time I did it, it wasn't. I think because it was literally 2 or 3 years from the time I'd actually written the section I read from. And there's also something, I mean, definitely the most magical moment with any book's production is the day that carton arrives from your publisher with the very first copy.
That must be real exciting.
Yeah.
Do you jump up and down, or do you scream, or what do you do?
I'm always in awe of it. I just stand there looking at it like it's some sort of Egyptian idol or something, I think. But, you know, it's the smell of the pages, and somehow everything about it in that moment looks fresh and new. It in no way resembles, you know, what was on my computer once or was even through all these editorial drafts. It's sort of its own new moment.
So what mystery is on your nightstand right now?
Well, I just finished the last of the Larson trilogy, and I'm deciding what to pick up next.
Okay.
Do you have a recommendation?
Yeah, a book by Val McDermott called Place of Execution.
Okay.
It is absolutely one of the most extraordinary mysteries you'll ever read.
I will put that on my nightstand.
And it's in paper, so you can get a paper. But it's one of those unforgettable mysteries. It's one of those books you pick up and you think, I wonder how this is, and then you read it and it's just an incredible book. You'll know what I mean when you read it. And it's just one of those books. I highly recommend it. That's what I'm sure there are other ones, though.
Yeah.
I can't remember what my question was. I'm totally thrown now.
That's always on my nightstand. I'll tell you what I did.
Oh, I did, before we end, and we have to end in a few minutes, unfortunately. It's been a wonderful time talking to you. But book 3, does it have a title yet?
It has a title that I don't think is going to stick. I'm calling it An Oath of Silence.
An Oath of Silence.
Somehow I don't think that's the title.
They may have a little trouble with that because Linda Castillo is writing books all with silence in the title now.
Yeah.
So they may make you change it.
There's a lot of Silent Hour by Michael Credit. There's a lot of silence in a lot of titles. So.
Do you have any idea what you'll change it to?
No. It may be like A Curtain Falls, where I just simply am brainstorming and come up with about 30 titles.
Well, that's a great title, A Curtain Falls, because it implies that the curtain's falling. It also implies that there's some kind of mystery about. And there's a lot of implications just saying the title.
Exactly.
And that's and as was In the Shadow of Gotham. They're both very mysterious titles, and then the snow being on the cover and the darkness and the gloominess of the covers makes you want to open the book up to read it. I think it works. I think it's very effective.
Yeah. I'm one of those authors who always believes that it's never so much about the title, it's about that marriage of the title and the cover scene together. You know, a story about In the Shadow of Gotham, that was my original title for it, actually. And I never loved it. And my editor wasn't in love with it either. You know, we had the whole discussion about how we would probably change the title when the time came. And when the time came, St. Martin's gave me this incredible cover. And suddenly seeing the title on that cover, it was perfect. and we all loved it from that moment on. But, you know, just on it.
Well, I assume now that you have more clout, now that you've won the Edgar, that you have, you know, your staying power of being able to publish a book is much greater than it would have been.
I hope so. We'll see.
Well, you definitely have a lot of talent. It's just, it's extraordinary the way you can write. And like I said, I'm hungering for the third. I'm going to finish the first one and hunger for the third one. But I must mention, everybody out there, please make sure you read In the Shadow of Gotham before you read A Curtain Falls. It's very important that you do. It's been great to talk to you.
Oh, same with you, David. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Thank you. And the new book's called A Curtain Falls. It's out from Minotaur Books, and you can get In the Shadow of Gotham. That's out in paperback. And this has been David's Book Talk, and we will talk to you next time.